doctrinal, practical series in the church. We've looked at the Bible. We've looked at the gospel. We've looked at baptism. We've looked at Lord's Supper. Starting last Sunday, under George Crawford's teaching, we started as a ministry looking at elder rule. And that is something I am looking forward to returning back to. But for this morning's lesson, for this morning's time together as a ministry, I want to take a little break from that if you can. And I suppose my motive for doing so is really because of what I have been thinking about myself. I hope you understand that as a pastor, I never want to be accused of asking you to do something that I do not do myself. Something as simple as praying, something as simple as studying the scriptures, something as simple as being faithful to witnessing. And so I'm all the time myself trying to make sure that the very thing I am preaching, I am, at least by intention, though not by in any way perfection, that I'm practicing. And the Christmas break has been good for me. I jokingly talked to you guys earlier about how it's been for you, and I do sincerely hope it's been enjoyable for you. I do sincerely hope that it has been, as some have even said to me this morning, it has been a break. A break from the routine, a break from the normal disciplines of study and academics and athletics and all the commitments you have to hobbies. We even have taken a break from the ministry routine of our Bible studies. And I hope that in that absence of time, you have taken advantage of the break. I myself, for the last couple of weeks, have had the opportunity to read more than I have had in the past. I've had the opportunity to just think more. And yet I must confess, as I think about my Christmas break, it maybe is a little different from your Christmas break. Not because I know you and how you spend it, but because I know how I was as a teenager and maybe how it was spent. I know for myself as a teenager, I didn't like breaks. Breaks was almost seen as a bad thing in this sense. I didn't like not having something to do. Not having something to do, it was equated with boredom. It was equated with something's wrong. There's a tragedy. There's, you know, this isn't good. And so as a teenager myself, I found myself always in activity, always engaged, always doing something. And if I wasn't in school and I wasn't on the ball field or I wasn't in the pool swimming, then I was at least doing something else. And maybe as a teenager, you can relate to this and you find yourself all the time on the phone and then you find yourself all the time on the computer and you find yourself playing games and you find yourself, doing different things, talking with people, hanging out at friends' houses, just being involved and engaged and engaged and engaged and engaged and engaged. And really almost as a teenager finding yourself, because I know I did myself, finding yourself almost uncomfortable with silence, uncomfortable with stillness. It's part of the reason why young people have such difficulty coming before the Lord and being quiet and having consistent prayer time and consistent Bible study time, because they're just not used to that. They just need to be running and going and all the time moving and shaking. If that's not happening, then something's wrong, and that is not true. And I could think of, and I think probably if one of the things that concerned me as a teenager is that when I stopped and was still and actually had maybe one meaningful thought the whole year, what was I thinking about? What was I focused on? What was I resolved to be set upon in my mind and to be considering? And I'd have to say, for teenagers, that can be a very difficult thing to do. For some of you, you don't want to take a look at reality. Because reality is cold and it's hard and it seems mean and it seems cruel. For some of you, reality is a home in which it isn't like the ordinary Christmas. It's financially lacking. Gifts aren't excessive. If anything, they're barely present. For others of you, it's not about so much the Christmas season as it's just about the reality that Christmas season points out about how family is not this ideal family, how you can watch sitcoms all day long, but we don't live like that in my house. My parents fight all day long. Homes are difficult and things are bad. Or maybe in a blessing from the Lord, you have a good situation. It's so good that you don't even realize how good it is because in your mind, you're discontent and it never is what it should be in your mind. So whether you have a right perspective that you don't want to think about, or you have a wrong perspective that you should be thinking about, oftentimes teenagers fail to come to the right conclusions in how they're viewing their life. It's only as good as what kind of deal they got at the mall. It's only as good as what new CD they got for Christmas. It's only as good as what movie just came out. And life is so much more than that. It's also at this time of year, much more than the time of Christmas, but at this time of the year that really as a society, I suppose, as a culture, I can't speak with any specificity to other cultures, but particularly in an American culture where we, you know, celebrate the end of one year, we talk about the beginning of a new year, and in that kind of conversation, maybe we do stop for a second and we look back. We say, what's it been like? Maybe in the midst of the busyness, we do stop and we actually consider what should be considered. How did last year look? I mean, let me ask you that right now, just to think about that yourself. How did 2004 look like in your life? Good, bad, indifferent? We're standing literally on the front doorstep to 2005, looking into a new year. And though sometimes these things can be trivial where we examine life based on a year, it is, I suppose, if in nothing else, helpful. Because life, when you think about it, seems great, it seems vast, it seems large, and in your world, a week can seem like an eternity. Let alone have to talk about the next year at a glance. I remember when I was your age, when it came time to planning things, I had a hard enough time planning beyond 1 week time span. I mean, now I'm not even joking. I was like, you know, what are you doing next week? Next week? Dude, I don't know. That's next week. I mean, you know how far that is? What are we doing today? And now I find myself married and with children and in ministry and having to think literally years down the road to make sure I have given due consideration, that I've given careful thought to what it is I actually want to accomplish. So here we are in the midst of this busyness with the need to stop. Here you are as teenagers in the midst of environments that perhaps you want to run from or environments that you should run to, but you stop, you fail to stop and to think about and to say, what should be your consideration? Maybe 2004 has flown by, or maybe it has not. Maybe 2005 is something you want to be different, or maybe you want it to be exactly the same. It does, after all, come to that time of the year where regardless of whether it was good or bad, we usually come to that time where we all kind of talk about it, whether you're young or old, whether you are on the college campus or high school campus or you're in a business environment, people talk about New Year's resolutions and what we're going to do this year, what's going to be different. I'm curious, by way of show of hands, I won't ask you what they are, so don't worry about embarrassing yourself. How many of you have made at least one New Year's resolution? One New Year's resolution? Come on, put them up high. Here we go. New Year's resolution. All right. That's fair. That's fair. A lot of you. Yeah. Others of you are just still too shy. Can you raise your hand? I know. Pinky wave. I know. Eyebrow. Hey. I did. I know. That's teenagers. You're worried like that. I understand. Resolutions. So a good majority, 2/3, 3/4 of the room. Yeah, I've made some resolutions, and maybe you have made some resolutions. That's not a bad thing. Resolutions can be a good thing. I mean, you have to ask yourself, what were they? That's what determines how good the resolution really is. Ultimately, we've made plenty of them. I know I have. I've made so many that I'm just tired of making them. At least the kind of ones I used to make. In fact, I was writing yesterday with a friend of mine, and he asked me, he said, hey, have you made some New Year's resolutions? And he was giving some joking examples. I said, no, I just got tired of making all those. You know how that works, right? You know, I resolve this year, I'm going to lose 5 pounds by February. And then like you're 2 days in the gym, you're sore as all get out. You can't even walk. I mean, you're so sore. And then, you know, like the next week, you're like, well, I'm done with that. Kidding me? Where's the Fritos at, man? I need those. That's what I'm looking for. I resolved to eat more Fritos this year. But let me just put us on the same page. By definition, when you say you make a New Year's resolution, and forget the term New Year's, when you make a resolution, by definition, what you're saying is that you are determining a course of action that's to be decided upon. You're making a decision about something that you will do, something that you will participate in, something that you will say, something that you will do, something that you will think. It's a resolution that you make. Unfortunately, and I've given you just comical examples, and by your laughter, I'm assuming you can relate to these, resolutions are so excessive in their number, so almost trivial and what their deciding factors are, that resolutions really don't seem to mean anything these days. They seem to be just, you know, I decide to lose 5 pounds. I decide, you know, not to eat chocolate for a whole day. I decide to do different things like that. Well, let me tell you about a different story. A day and a time when resolutions meant something, just like they can today. It's not about me. I'm unfortunate. I'm sad to say I don't have any good examples about me as a teenager to give. So let me give you an example of another teenager. A teenager that had made some resolutions. They were not because of the beginning of a new year, as we commonly do, but they were simply because this teenager wanted to give his life purpose. He wanted to give his life some direction without wasting the years that he knew, Lord willing, God was going to continue to give to him. So he made some resolutions. This teenager was born in the 1700s, and in his 55-year lifespan, he gained the reputation of only living on the planet for 55 total years. He gained the reputation of being the greatest theologian and philosopher in American history, as well as having a significant role in the future and the shaping of the future American church, what we live in today. What's amazing is to think that this teenager possessed the mental capacity, the personal desire, and the personal examination and scrutiny to be able to write out 70 resolutions. Not one, not two, not three. 70 resolutions that he made as a teenager. But these resolutions were much more than lose weight by March. These resolutions were much more than be nice to my sister and share my my room or my car with my brother. These resolutions that he made were based on Scripture, and they steered him through life. They gave him direction and helped him to become one of the most prominent and powerful forces in what was later called the Great Awakening, the revival that came into American history, that grew out of a teenager's resolutions. He was relentless in his pursuit of God. Going on later, after being a teenager, to become a pastor, he preached with such intensity that people would run to the front to repent, penetrating the hearts with the power of the gospel. The teenager that I'm speaking about is a man that we know of today called Jonathan Edwards. Now let me highlight a few of Jonathan Edwards' resolutions to you so that you can get a taste of what he resolved to do, much more than what are our common resolutions today. He said this in the beginning of his resolutions. He says, "Being sensible that I am unable to do anything without God's help, I do humbly entreat Him, request of Him," he says, "by His grace to enable me to keep these." So he starts his resolutions with probably what we should all start with. The reality that if we trust that we're going to fulfill our own resolutions by our own strength, it's no different than losing the weight or stop eating chocolate or saying no to candy or sugar or whatever else it is. He says, "I can only do these resolutions I'm about to pen based upon God's grace in my life to enable me to do them, as long as they're agreeable to His will for Christ's sake." And then he wrote, "I will remember to read these resolutions at least once a week." Let me give you some examples. Resolution number 7. "I am resolved never to do anything which I should be afraid to do if it were the last hour of my life." Translation, "I will live every hour of my life as if it's the last." No regret, no frustration, no wish I would have done something different. I resolve in my life to live every hour as if it was the last. Number 10, "I resolved that when I feel pain," in any sense, he would say this. If he cut himself, if he hurt, if he in any sense felt pain, to think of the pains of martyrdom, people dying for their salvation, people dying for Christ, and to think of the pains of hell. Number 14, "I resolved never to do anything out of revenge." Number 37, "Resolved to inquire every night as I'm going to bed, every night, wherein I have been negligent, what sin I have committed, and wherein I have denied myself, also at the end of every week and every month and every year, to do a self-examination of his life." Number 40, he writes, resolve to inquire every night before I go to bed whether I have acted in the best way I possibly could with respect to simply eating and drinking. That's the detail he considered. And then just last one, but it's of course not all of them. Number 70, let there be something of benevolence, something of grace would be the term, in everything that I speak. As a teenager, he said that. And yet teenagers today, myself included, that is often the last thing that's said of teenage speech. Gracious. A teenager was all that he was when he wrote these 70 resolutions, and he lived by them for the rest of his life. I mean, let me ask you a question. How many resolutions have you made in your life? How many of those have you kept? How many of those had any eternal significance as opposed to personal benefit, beauty, vanity, material possessions, gaining wealth, etc.? Well, if you're having trouble making some proper resolutions, let me help you this morning with some that I have for you to consider. Some resolutions for teenagers. I would say specifically the resolutions that I want to give to you this morning that you need to consider are not like Edward's, though I would encourage you to read his and to study his and to make them yours by the power of grace. The resolutions that specifically apply to you as a teenager in your life today, living in the world you live in today, in the home you live in today. Now, I understand you don't all live in the same homes. I understand not all of you have parents that are married. I understand not all of you have parents that are saved. None of them are saved. Some of them are saved, or all of them are saved. I know it runs the gamut. And you cannot control those circumstances, but you can control how you respond to those circumstances. If you make the proper resolutions. It is a tragedy that today's teenager is trying as hard as they can to run from their parents. As hard as they can to run from what God has offered as an umbrella of protection for the teenager by way of provision, protection, and direction. I say this because I thought this way myself as a teenager. I'm sure maybe others of you are thinking this way, particularly if you're in your junior or senior years. And that is this, the attitude, boy, I can't wait till I get out of my house. I mean, I can't wait. As soon as I turn 18, I am gone. When I was a senior in high school, he asked me where I wanted to go to college, or actually earlier, asked me where I wanted to go to college. I said, oh, I want to go to college in Germany. Germany. You're going to, did I speak German? No. I have like a great love for Europe, you know, that I want to be in Germany? No. I just wanted to be out. I want to be away from my parents because no matter where I was, it was going to be better. Where I could go is going to be better than where I was at that time. And I'm sure as a teenager, you struggle with this kind of consideration. You struggle with the understanding that Proverbs says is a response that you are to have as children, though older, children to your parents. Turn, if you will, to Proverbs. As I lay this groundwork for you here and that you understand these resolutions. Because I think it perhaps we would do well to return to the words of Proverbs chapter 4. And we listen to the father's instruction as we get a picture of the parent's role in the child's life. Proverbs chapter 4. Solomon writes, hear, O sons, the instruction of a father, and give attention that you may gain understanding. For I give you sound teaching. Do not abandon my instruction. When I was a son to my father, tender and the only son in the sight of my mother, then he taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words. Keep my commandments and live. Acquire wisdom, acquire understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, and she will guard you. Love her, and she will watch over you. The beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom, And with all your acquiring, get understanding. Prize her, and she will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place you on your head a garland of grace, and she will present you with a crown of beauty. Hear my son, and accept my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. Now stop right there. What's important for you to understand as a child, regardless of the home you live in, is the resolution you must make, almost the presupposition, meaning the thought that is before the decision you make, the understanding you have of your relationship to your family. You say, why in the world are you going into this? Because so much of what I see in teenagers' lives, as far as the consequence of sin, the frustration, the depression, the discouragement, could be so easily avoided if they simply followed the path that God gave to them clearly from the Scripture, and that is a path that the parents have laid out. And sometimes, and quite oftentimes, that's even the path that the non-Christian parent lays out as God uses them. But there has to be a willingness on your behalf to respond. Turn to the two chapters ahead, Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6, look at verse 20. He continues to write here. He says, my son, observe the commandment of your father. Do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. When you awake, they will talk to you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching is light, and the reproofs for discipline are the way of life. Now stop right there. Another passage that explains the role that a mother and a father play in a child's life, be they young or be they old. To observe the commandment of the father, to not forsake the teaching of your mother. It describes the attitude in which you take towards them as being in such a way that no matter where you go, you consider what would your parents want you to do. And it's so sad to see today, if there is anything that this culture teaches today, it is independence. It is rebellion at the expense of every possible good thing that you could have, even a good relationship with your parents. In fact, our culture is so bizarre today, there's even examples in which children are allowed, get this, children are allowed to divorce their parents because of the case that they have made to the court system of why they should not be with their parents. That's how perverted our society is in allowing children to step away from the instruction, from the direction, from the protection God gives to children, God gives to young men and young women like yourselves in your life. Now let me begin to work through what I believe would be some proper resolutions for you to make. And I hope I've caught you at the right time, at least at the time of the year that you're thinking about such things. Beyond saying no to chocolate, beyond saying no to buying no more than four outfits a week. I know some of you, that's a struggle. To give you some resolutions that you as a teenager should make, specifically as these speak to the relationship that you have with your mother and father. Number one, I will obey, speaking to the parents, you speaking to your parents, I will obey your instructions and do what I know you expect of me, even when it is not mentioned. I will not force you into repeated reminders, which I sometimes call nagging. How many of you can identify with that? Those repeated reminders that your mom and dad give you, something as simple as making your bed, taking out the trash, and you're going, Mom, Mom, stop. I know. Why are you always nagging me like that? Answer, if you would obey the first time when you were instructed to, you wouldn't be having the nagging going on in your life. Because all the nagging is repeated reminders because of your delayed obedience. By the way, if you want to write these down, I just want to save you the pain of having to catch all this. You're welcome to get this audio message. We'll put it on the web for you as we're trying to catch up and do with all the messages. So you can just hopefully listen along here. So the first one that you resolve is to be able to obey your parents' instructions, doing what they expect of you to do, even when it's not mentioned. I mean, can you imagine the revolution that would take place in the homes today if every teenager, let's just start with the 200 present here, did this? Actually did what your parents asked, and actually did what your parents didn't ask, but expected of you. Oh. Oh. I mean, you can imagine, you'd be like, where is my child? What have you done with them? This is so unexpected of you. Your laughter, as funny as it is and its appreciation, you can identify with the fact that your parents struggle so hard to get you to obey their instruction. That should never be the testimony of a Christian son or daughter. Never. Secondly, resolved. I will not grumble or complain when I do my chores, but will remember what a great thing it is to have a family, to have a home, to have clothes, to have food, to have running water, to have electric lights, and have central heating in a world where millions of teenagers have none of these. Boy, if there ever was a time in history to learn this lesson of the thankfulness that you should have, it would be now. If you were in church this morning, you heard our pastor speak about it. If you have had your head anywhere above the sand the last week, you would know about it. To understand what's happening on the other side of the world right now, the 117,000 plus people, as the numbers rise every single day, that are dead, the hundreds of thousands of people, millions are left homeless, and we can complain about what? I didn't like the shoes Mom got me. And in case you think that these are just sort of pithy little statements that don't seem to have any biblical relevance or instruction, may I remind you that that is not the case. In fact, if you were to remember 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, in the midst of many of his instructions, Paul writes to the Thessalonians, "In everything give thanks." Why? "For this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus." How many teenagers wish they knew God's will? God's will on college, God's will on dating, God's will on career, God's will on anything. I just want to know God's will. Why is it that you want to know more of God's will when the God's will that you do clearly know you're not so good at obeying? In everything, give thanks. As a teenager, you should be resolved not to grumble or complain when you're asked to do your chores, but to remember what a great thing it is to have the things you have. A family, home, clothes, food, water, electricity, heating. I confess myself, it gets cold in Southern California. Cold means anything less than 60 degrees. I go to my closet. I look at like 5 jackets I decide I want to wear. Let's see how that will look. I mean, my perspective of how blessed I am is so sometimes tainted. It should not be that way for me. It should not be that way for you. Thirdly, you should be resolved that when you think your demands are unfair, you will move to do them first. And after showing an obedient attitude, you will ask if you can talk to your parents about them. And then you will explain your side and try to understand the parent's side. Notice that relationship, what happens here. Notice, if you will, the sequence. It does not say, if you think your demands are unfair, protest outside the house. We're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. No, we're not going to do it. You know, in a protest. It doesn't say that. It says, if they think the demands upon your life, you know, like curfew by 10. Oh, when was my mom born? Curfew by 10. That's unreasonable. I'm 12 years old. What is she thinking? That's how you think. If you think your demands are unfair, you do not protest. You do it first. Why? Because you establish that your starting point is obedience. You demonstrate to your parents you desire obedience. even at the expense of maybe personal discomfort or personal dislike. After establishing the obedience and proving that to your parents, then maybe if time does allow and the relationship does permit, after showing your obedient attitude, you say, hey, Mom, Dad, can we talk about this? All the time I have the opportunity to sit down with teenagers like yourselves. You guys, a lot of times. And your parents. And I think sometimes you guys think, you know, when we get in this room that it's going to be like, you know, gang up on teenage time. You're like, boy, I'm really outnumbered in this room. And that's never the case. I think as every person who's ever sat in my office has understood, I have been as much an ally for the teenager as I have been for the parent. And I have engaged in conversations like curfew and engaged in conversations like allowance and have been willing to help dialogue about those kind of things. But I have to say to the teenager, you give me little room to be able to work with you on from the bargaining ability when your whole life has been disobedience and rebelliousness. Maybe the teenager really has a decent concern that, you know, I'm not allowed to watch television but once a month. That might be a little extreme, maybe in the home. I don't know. I mean, it's a parent's prerogative. I can't say that they're wrong. I can say maybe we could talk about this. But I don't even have much ability to talk about the parent with this if the teenager is like the biggest jerk on the planet. Establish the obedience. Fourth resolution. Teenager responds. Teenager's resolution is, I will not stonewall my parents or give my parents the silent treatment, which I dislike when my friends do to me. If I'm depressed and I want to be left alone, I will say, I'm sorry. I don't feel like talking right now. Can we talk later? I'm not mad. I just need to be alone. One of the greatest frustrations parents have with teenagers is communication. One of the greatest things parents want to do with you is to talk. And what so frustrates them is it isn't like you've entered into this mime ministry for your teenage years that, you know, you've somehow lost the ability to control your tongue and you can't use it. They know that's not true. Why? Because they see you for hours upon hours, like centuries upon centuries on the phone talking to anybody and everybody. Literally, you'll like go through the Rolodex, like 20 people aren't home, but you got to keep calling to talk to somebody. And yet, when they sit down with you and say, how was your day? You're like, fine. To be resolved as a teenager that you will not stonewall your parents. You will not stiff-arm your parents. Your parents want to talk with you even more, as hard as this might be for you to understand, than you want to talk with your friends. Because the relationship they desire to have with you is even more important than the relationship you desire to have with your friends. And if there's a time when maybe it's been a bad day, maybe you sincerely are emotionally sad, depressed, you're just kind of down. To be honest and say, I'm just not happy right now. Can we just talk later? But a teenager needs to be resolved, needs to make the resolution to communicate with their parents and not stonewall them. Number five, when I, as a teenager, do something wrong and let my parents down, I will apologize sincerely with words that my parents can hear. That phrase that I've put there is key. I will apologize sincerely. Some of you need help with this, so let me give you some indication. You've messed up. You're living a life of being messed up. As far as, you know, just the foolishness average of a teenager in their decision-making is typically a lot of things wrong. Because you're just sort of bumping along. It's like a bumper war contest as far as just kind of bad decision to bad decision. You're always having to kind of, oh, here, I'm back at it again kind of thing. To say to your parents sincerely, to apologize to them sincerely, which means that you are sincere. Now, sincerity does not look like this. Yeah, sorry, Mom. Okay, that's not sincere. Okay? Sincerity is not, yeah, Mom, I'm sorry. You know I'm sorry. I got to say this again. You know, if I wasn't sincere, I would tell you I wasn't sincere. I know I'm sincere. You should know I'm sincere. You know me. I'm your son. That's not sincerity. Sincerity is what you expect of others, so you should be expected of yourself, which is to look somebody in the eye and to say, Lori, I did something that was mean. and I'm sincerely sorry. Will you forgive me? The tone of my voice, Lori's like, what, did I do something wrong? The tone of my voice, the eye contact, and the seriousness of my attitude by which I even talked about my problems. Teenagers use humor today to cover serious issues. Serious issues. I'm telling you, humor has a place. It's a buffer for reality. But when you have to deal with the cold, hard facts of the fact that you messed up, don't be joking with your mom and dad about that. No one finds that funny. Don't be joking about the fact that you got a speeding ticket or that you got in a car accident or that you're late for curfew or that you got an F on your quiz. Just like you, Dad. Remember you said you had a hard time in algebra? That's not the time for that. A lot of your dads must have a hard time in algebra. I'm a dad, and I had a hard time in algebra. Say something sincerely like, Mom, I'm sorry I didn't pick up the pile of clothes that you asked me to. I'm sorry. Forgive me. The two hardest words to come out of anybody's mouth, young, old, single, or married, male or female, are the words, forgive me. I ask you, how often do you say that to your parents? How often do you see your disobedience as sin that needs to be forgiven? A relationship that has been split that needs to be made right? Forgive me, Mom. Forgive me, Dad. I messed up again. And I know this is the last conversation you ever want to have about this, but we're having it again. Forgive me. I challenge you. The greatest step you can take in humbling yourself in your Christianity is to be willing to recognize the fact every single day that you are a sinner in need of a Savior who has forgiven you. And that relationally, you still mess up with others and you need their forgiveness. Man, I can't imagine the conflict in homes where teenagers were living that would be resolved if teenagers were so much better at saying those two words. Forgive me. Resolution number 7. I will talk about my feelings, both the positive ones, like happiness, pity, excitement, sympathy, and the negative ones, like anger, fear, grief, loneliness, and discouragement. I will remember that unshared feelings lead to estrangement, coldness, and even more loneliness and discouragement. Teenage years can be incredibly lonely. Teenage years can be incredibly discouraging. It's amazing to me how a person, and I can relate to this, can have quote-unquote, so many friends, and yet feel so lonely. Can have everything going for them, and yet feel so discouraged and like the world's caving in on them. And that's not because necessarily you're right in thinking that, that it really is caving in, but it's because the emotions that you're having sometimes really gotten the better of you. And you need help with people in your life who have walked that path before you, who have felt that way before you, have experienced that before you, and can help walk you out of that. That valley, if you will. Parents can be that for you. To be able to talk and say, I'm lonely. Be able to talk and say, man, it's just been an awesome day. I mean, this is an incredibly happy day for me. Teenagers today are so worried about being cool, calm, and collective. You look good. You talk good. By golly, you're good. You know what? The truth is, you are going through more change in your life in 6 to 8 to 10 years of your life in these time spans that you're involved in right now than you'll go through in any other time of your life. The social changes, the physical changes, the emotional changes, the mental changes, the spiritual changes, the financial changes, the educational changes, the relational changes as far as marriage and children, and all of that that happens in such a small span of time in context of how long the average human being lives. It's understandable that you are confused, that you are lonely, that you're happy, that you're sad, that, you know, that you're like ADD like 1,000 times over within 1 hour. To bear that yourself and to not humble yourself and to talk to your mom and dad about it is to only make that situation worse. I'm amazed at how much teenagers, because I know this myself, will confide in their friends, but not in their parents. Here's why I'm amazed. Because their friends can only share in the problem, not in the solution. Man, it's just been a hard day. I know. Family's rough. I know. I thought he liked me. I thought he liked me too. Situations are just so bad all the time. What are you going to do? I don't know. What are you going to do? I don't know. What are we going to do? I don't know. You come in the door for dinner. There you are, you and your friend Jane. Hey, how's your day? Fine. Anything we can help you with? No. Then you get the teenagers who got all the problems and they go to, you know, they commit all these crimes and they say, why'd you commit all these crimes? Well, it's because my mom didn't love me. No one cared for me. They went there and I needed them. I'm telling you, it's your responsibility to communicate. It's your responsibility to take the initiative to go to the people that not only can identify with the problem, but have come out of those years to be able to point you toward the solution and the wisdom they can offer from the Scriptures. Number, I don't know what number we're on. 8. I'm resolved that I will give, and this is something I just wrote here that you maybe will find helpful. The number's not important. I will give 2 compliments for every criticism. 2 compliments for every criticism. And every criticism that I do give will aim to help someone, doesn't have to be parents, so we're not talking about parents here, will aim to help someone improve, not just belittle or cut down. May I remind you of what Ephesians says? Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29. Paul says, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. How many people think that about your conversation? I tell you, the best way to examine your friendships, you have the circle of friends, let's say. You know, there's like the 5 of you. 2 of you are present. The other one is speaking. What does that other one say about the other 3 when they're not present? Whatever they say about the other 3, I can promise you they say about you when you're not present. The story might change a little, but it's true. Because why? Because these people don't know how to be friends. Because their words are critical. Their words are cutting. Their words are slanderous. Their words are gossip. They're not edifying. They're not gracious. They're not kind. You want to find a friend that already has existing friends, and when they talk about their friends and somebody talks about them, they always come to their defense when they're not present. Hey, did you hear about Mary? She's always late. I'm sure there's a good reason for that. What do you mean? Well, I mean, she's, you know, only got 1 mom. She works 2 jobs, and I'm sure it's a hard time getting to school on time. Oh. Okay. You want the kind of friend that is always coming to the defense of others, that even when criticism is offered, it's the intention to think the best or the intention to want the best, the intention to hope the best, because that's what love does. Let me finish here with 2 more very quickly. More to be given, but I don't have the time. If you're interested, I can give these to you later. I'm resolved that I will read my Bible and pray every day, even if it is only a verse and a brief call for help. I know that I myself as a teenager cannot live by bread alone, but every word that comes out of the mouth of God. Who else said that? In Matthew? None other than Jesus Christ himself, when he was tempted by Satan. How much more should we think that way? I'll stop there, because I think that's a great one to end on. Make a resolution that says, I will read my Bible and pray every day, even if it's only a verse in a brief prayer, a brief call, a brief conversation, a brief, God, I need to talk to you. I've only got a minute. I know I should have more, but I need to talk to you right now. Things aren't good. To have a constant relationship with the Lord and to understand that you do not live based on an allowance. You do not live based on a clothing budget. You do not live based on how recent the CD stack is. You do not live based on, you know, what the latest sports team is doing. You live based on what comes from God and what He provides for you. Your eyes, your mind, your mouth is feasting every single day on so much around you. Feasting on the internet, feasting on friends, feasting on television, feasting on computer games, feasting on retail clothing stores. It's feasting, it's feasting, it's feasting. And it's carnivorous, it never seems to have enough. It's insatiable, it never seems to be consumed. It always wants more. Find your fulfillment as a teenage Christian where you should, in the pages of Scripture. Because when you do, it only puts you back in the cycle that we started off with resolution number one. I am resolved, according to Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1, I will obey my parents as unto the Lord. Because that's what honors God, and that's what my Bible tells me to do. Is 2005 going to be different? I pray to the Lord it will, for me and for you. And I pray that the years of Jonathan Edwards are not gone. That we don't have to quote guys from the 1700s. That we can quote your name next year. We can quote your name in 10 years and in 20 years. We can say, remember that group of teenagers at Grace Community Church? Man, they are resolved. Not just in their statements, but in how they live their life as teenage Christians. That's how you should be living in 2005. That's what you should be thinking about. Let's pray.